Thank y'all so much. This will be a little bit of what we talked about an hour or so ago, but there seem to be a lot of questions, so please feel free to ask questions. I certainly have an opinion about most things, I guess, but I also don't know a lot, so this is what helps me learn too. So speak up on things you do and tactics that you use, because I do learn a lot from that, and it's all about kind of trying to do the right thing, right? So anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about making decisions with cranial cruciate ligament disease and when we should do which procedure and what and how we should be treating these guys to try to come up with the best method and try to at least get in our minds how we can make the right decision for each patient. It is possibly cranial cruciate ligament rupture is possibly the most common thing that we see again. We see two categories of presentation. Those older dogs that have been limping along a while with the degenerative process, and then the younger dogs that we see trauma as very much a part of their disease process. Most often though, we see the insidious onset, the poster child, the 5-6-year-old overloved Labrador that limps up to your front door. Those are the dogs that we generally see, the older ones. But don't forget that it does happen in young dogs. It is an insidious onset because sometimes these dogs can suffer from a partial tear and they can be just subtly lame, and they can go on for months to even years with that subtle lameness until either the cruciate ligament goes ahead and completely ruptures, or there's been a meniscal injury. The economic considerations are such that I think we do need to be concerned about cranial cruciate ligament disease. Lots of money is spent both on a conservative and a surgical management, or both in the surgical and management areas of this disease. So how can anatomy predispose? And to understand the procedures that we've bought into, such as the TPLO and the tibial tuberosity advancement, I think that we need to talk about anatomy a little bit more with the cranial cruciate ligament and with the composition of the knee. Most dogs do suffer from an increase in tibial slope. When we do go to measure, we do talk about tibial slope. The way that we measure this is basically from the insertion of the cranial and caudal cruciate ligaments. So when we're making these points, we come off the insertion of the cranial cruciate ligament. We put a dot at the tibial eminences, and then somewhere around the area here caudally that we assume that might represent the caudal cruciate ligament. It is a little bit low, but we come off the top of the fibular head. So that gives us our caudal slope. That's the slope we're working with in a dog that is cruciate deficient. Also, the other anatomical considerations that we talk about, you may or may not have read about intracondylar notch problems. Those dogs that have very narrow notches that over time, because of the twisting and the movement and the way that the origin of the cranial and caudal cruciate ligament is, they become pinched or they become damaged in some way and can cause a problem with the integrity of the ligament. Also, limb angulation, the way that these dogs stand. You see those dogs oftentimes too, and an anatomical consideration are these dogs with super straight legs that you've probably seen, Akitas, Labradors. Those are the dogs too that you oftentimes can see canine hip dysplasia be a consideration. So how does one come up with a plan? How do you synthesize, you know, what are the types of things that we have to deal with? We have to look at the age of the animal. That's important. Age, thankfully, is not a disease, but age is a very, very much a consideration for owners because they have to decide what they want to put these dogs through. Just the other day, I had a 13-year-old German Shepherd that came in and had a ruptured cruciate ligament. I think it had been going on for a while, but it is something that it would be very easy to go, oh, your dog needs a TPLO, definitely. But I mean, come on, you know, how long is it going to be before that dreaded hemangiosarcoma is going to happen or something else, you know? No, you just have to be honest with people and say age is not a disease, but we have to make sure that what we're recommending makes sense. And, you know, is this dog a candidate that we have good bone healing? Are they systemically healthy? Also, we have to deal with weight. Those nice, big, oversized, chunky Labradors. I have been known in a few cases to send these dogs out the door for rehabilitation prior to TPLO and send them for some very constructive, concentrated rehabilitation in the underwater treadmill, all the while risking maybe a meniscal tear. I mean, these dogs will walk on the limb. They're not that painful, but we're pretty certain that they either have a partial or complete tear of their cranial cruciate ligament. So again, no one surgical procedure is accepted. We've got lots of options. We've got things that we can recommend all the day long, but the fact of the matter is that there needs to be a right one for the right patient. Traditionally, dogs under 15 kilograms have been known to be able to be left alone to their own devices and do quite well with the period of rest. However, we can't take the meniscal tear back. Over 50 different types of surgeries have been described, and we could just spend all our time describing all those 50, but I don't really know that either any of us are that interested in knowing the subtle differences between them. There are two big categories, either the repair that we consider going inside or intra-articularly to stabilize the knee, or those that are stabilization either in a static or dynamic fashion exist outside the knee. The good news is that they are going to benefit more often than not, and largely more often than not, from a surgical intervention. So our goals of surgery, we need this knee to be stable during weight bearing. That pretty much encompasses everything if we have a successful repair. Weight bearing is the most important. When the dog's laying there in front of the fire, it probably doesn't matter that the knee is stable. It's going to be dynamically stable in the case of the TPLO, but not so when he's laying on his side. You need to address a goal of surgery, and probably, arguably, as far from a pain standpoint, addressing the meniscus is very important. You need to go in the joint either by arthrotomy or arthroscopy and look at both the medial and lateral meniscus. In more cases than not, the medial meniscus is going to be the tissue that's going to get torn, the caudal and medial meniscus. But don't forget to look at the lateral meniscus, because we do every once in a while see those isolated lateral tears. Lateral meniscal tears in dogs are a very bad thing. The lateral meniscus is very much a portion of the stability of the knee. And if you get a dog, it seems like boxers seem to be the ones that we see. If you get a dog that has a lateral meniscal tear, you have to be honest with the owner about prognosis. These dogs don't do as well postoperatively. We also want a surgery that can return these guys to function as quickly as possible. Especially in the case of the TPLO, you can be 3 to 4 months to get that tibia to heal, but if that's the best procedure for a very active dog, a very active Labrador that hunts, then it may be worth the time. However, if you have a dog that's in a certain amount of disability and you need a quick and dirty project and you need to be able to go ahead and get that knee stable with the extra capsule repair, this may be one that you still need a good 8 weeks for periarticular fibrosis to occur and have the knee be stable. We want to slow that progression of osteoarthritis. We can't take that back. And that's why we also get pretty aggressive about implementing whatever procedure you decide to do. Once arthritis is there, that's going to be the thing that is going to keep these animals from returning to 100%. The function of the cranial cruciate ligament prevents hyperextension in the knee, prevents cranial translation of the tibia, and also a certain amount of internal rotation. Also, we have two bands that it's comprised of, and this is important in the case of partial tears. You have the cranial medial band and the caudal lateral. This is important when you're examining these guys. You need to make sure that when you're palpating these animals in flexion and extension, or that you're implementing flexion and extension when you're trying for cranial drawer. The reason is more often than not, that cranial medial band will tear when you have a partial rupture. That means that you, when the leg is in extension, that caudal lateral band is still intact, and you may not get cranial translation. But when you flex the knee, that caudal lateral band becomes very loose, and the cranial medial band is ruptured, and that's when you're going to get some cranial deviation of the tibia. So does that make sense? That's the only reason that I spend any time trying to memorize which band is which, and that's because I need to remember to put the limb through flexion and extension when you're doing cranial drawer. Over time, with a cranial cruciate ligament rupture, the instability lends itself to osteoarthritis. Instability also, too, as we've kind of talked about ad nauseum, I mean, think about it. You've got cranial translation of the tibia, and that entraps that medial meniscus, and it causes it to be pinched and eventually torn. It's very well attached to the tibial plateau. And so if we're looking at the femoral component here, we can see that, you know, it's a nice glistening surface, but very much something that could be ruptured. So when we do have a situation in which this medial meniscus becomes torn, this again is the area that we're talking about becoming traumatized. And if we're looking at it arthroscopically, we've got the caudal cruciate ligament here, the medial meniscus is here, and what has happened is that with this tear here, this has come forward and flopped over on itself, and so when we have the scope in there and get the fat pad debrided away, we're able to see that meniscus. With a probe, we pull that forward and we cut that either with a small hook knife or a smaller blade, and are able to pull that forward and either shave it down or remove it with small forceps. But let's not forget the intracapsular repair. Many have devoted their lives to the intracapsular repair, both physicians and veterinarians. The intracapsular repair truly replaces that ligament. It's going to follow the exact course of that cranial cruciate ligament. We can use autogenous materials, such as the patellar tendon or some sort of fascial material. You can also use an artificial graft, and for quite a while, especially on the human side, and I think even presently, they'll use cadaver grafts. That was done with canines for a while, and I don't really know anybody that's using artificial grafts anymore. Mostly the people that I know that still do the intracapsular repairs are using autogenous tissue, and most commonly the straight patellar tendon. It is very technically demanding, and I've tried to do a few, and boy, I just said a few choice words about that. Once you get that straight patellar tendon dissected, the one-third that you're going to use, you've got to be very specific about where you're putting these tunnels. And I tell you, you know, don't you see where you're putting that? It's like, not really. They are very technically challenging, but I tell you, if you see somebody that's really good at them, it really makes sense, and I think it's a good technique to use. However, they found in the most recent literature really supports the extracapsular repairs in the form of extracapsular sutures and TPLOs, and they didn't include the TTA, but they really had a superior performance when compared to the intracapsular repairs. And most often that's because the graft material tends to loosen and become a little bit lax quicker, and you don't get that good periarticular fibrosis and stabilization like you do with the extracapsular repair or the lateral fibular tibial suture. Extracapsular repair, we just talked about an hour or so ago, and it really still continues to be a very popular repair, continuing to make some good advancements and I think some positive changes in it. It is, and you know, you can take this and you can quote a lot of surgeons on this, that it is applicable to all size dogs done properly. I really believe that. Whether or not you're specifically recommending is certainly your business, but you can apply this procedure to any size animal. The way that I approach this and when I talk to owners is I go in and I try my very best to be unbiased. And I explain both procedures. If I do feel strongly that one procedure is better than the other, then I will tell them that, especially if they ask. But if you go in and let's say all you offer is TPLOs, you know, I still would explain both procedures, and then I would give them the option to pursue the extracapsular repair with someone else, and vice versa. You know, educate people, explain the procedures and how they're different and the pros and cons of each one, and then let them make their decision. I mean, again, if I feel strongly one way or the other, if I see a four-year-old very athletic Labrador that I think would respond well to TPLO, then I'll say that, and I'll tell them that I think that's the better procedure. But I think that with education, you can give good recommendations to all people and offer that. We want the sutures to be placed again where it mimics most closely the cranial cruciate ligament, and so many variations with the extracapsular repair, the medial and lateral suture, the types of materials that we can use, the fastening devices that we can use, and the anchoring points again, as I talked about the isometric points, that site that's just on the lateral aspect below the fibula on the femoral condyle and in the most caudal and proximal portion of the tibia has found to be a very satisfactory point of anchoring. fibular head transpositions in which the fibular head is detached and moved cranially to use that lateral collateral ligament as a new cranial cruciate ligament was a procedure, a technique that was in favor a few years ago, probably 15 years ago. And I think that it's very technically challenging. I've never done one myself. I've never even been shown how to do it. But I've talked to people anyway that have done these. They've moved it forward. The fibular head then needs to be reattached with some small wires. I think technically it's very challenging, but people have had good success. I don't presently know anybody that does those, but I'd appreciate to hear if anybody's had good success with them, because you just don't hear about them being talked about much. The results are good in most cases with cranial cruciate ligament. You have a very limited complication rate, but it is hard to eliminate all the cranial drawer. But is that necessary? Normally, the knee holds about 3 millimeters of cranial drawer normally. With an intact cruciate ligament, cranial cruciate ligament. So when we're going to tighten our suture material, if we've decided we want to use an extra capsule repair, I think it's good to get them snug, but it's not absolutely imperative to have 0 millimeters of cranial drawer. So you just don't want an excessive amount of drawer, because then you've not really accomplished anything by stabilizing the knee. Prosthetic materials are difficult to handle and secure, but we're overcoming that slowly but surely with different sizes of material and types of materials. Sutures will stretch and break, and that becomes very problematic and difficult sometimes for us to decide what size material to use. With the fluorocarbon in the monofilament nylon leaders, 1 pound of test per pound of body weight is most commonly what we use, 60-pound dog, 60-pound test. But when you're considering using some of the braided polyesters or the poly blends, such as fiber wire, that comes in number 2 and number 5, I would look at the package. I'd look at the package and say, okay, this equates to 175 newtons of force on the testing that they've done. Is that enough for a poodle? Is that enough for a Rottweiler? That's really hard to say. But generally, in some of these poly blends, I tend to still, on the bigger dogs, use fluorocarbon. So I know there are others that say they think that number 5 fiber wire is plenty for a Rottweiler, but I'm still a little bit leery, and I need to get a little bit more experience and read a little bit more of the literature. But it can be used. Again, the materials that we use. Don't mean to beat a dead horse here, but we just have so many choices with the different materials, fastening methods. Securos makes a nice crimp clamp system that works well. Knot, square knot is the best, so a sliding half hitch converted to a square knot is a good alternative. Also, sometimes, especially with the fluorocarbon, I'll do a surgeon's throw. This has not been examined on fluorocarbon specifically, but I'll use a smooth-jawed hemostat or a needle driver to clamp the middle, and then as I do my throw on top of my surgeon's throw, I'll have whoever is scrubbed in, if you have that opportunity to have somebody help you, take the clamp off as I'm tightening down. They showed in 60-pound monofilament nylon leader, that was not a detriment to the material. It did not deform the material. And in fact, it may have caused enough compression that would allow the knot to go ahead and tighten down, snug down into that material. Well, it may not be an option if you decide you want to use the crimp clamps, but there are so many options that we have for fastening methods. And again, anchorage points. I'm very high on trying to get things, if you haven't guessed, as biomechanically similar as we can. So to use the points that mimic the cranial cruciate ligament is certainly an advantage. Nice pictures of the crimp clamp system to be able to use one in the middle with 3 clamps in it. These were just used for the purpose of putting the tensioning device on. I'm so cheap now that I just make knots when I'm using a tensioning device, and the knot, it can go up against the knots and secure it. There was also a study that was recently done that what they would do is go ahead and clamp down once on the crimp clamp system and pull it, you know, and just enough to where it would be secure with one clamp, and then go ahead and finish it. So that can be done that way, and they didn't see any detriment on the material in that fashion. Also, I've seen people use instruments, needle drivers on each side of the clamp, and using their tensioning device so that they have a stopgap there. The 80-pound and 40-pound clamps are available. And to be truthful, the two systems that are available, I've only used the Securos. I haven't used the other system. But it's been tested and didn't have quite as favorable responses compared to the Securos when you were looking at braking. The always, regardless if you're using the crimp clamp system or a knotting system, your weak link is going to be your fastening device. But it has been shown time and time again that the crimp clamp system does seem to hold up a little bit better under stress than the knotting system. The 40-pound clamps in a study done by Dr. Banwell showed some slipping, and so that was problematic. And I don't know if that's been redesigned since 2005, but I don't tend to use clamps on 40-pound monofilament nylon leader. So again, to go over these points again, since I was getting a lot of questions on this, the isometric points, that distance between the two anchoring points that doesn't change during flexion and extension, more isometric anchoring position that allows normal or near normal joint motion is going to be biomechanically advantageous. And I guess in theory, it will prevent premature loosening of your material and will give you that good 10 to 12 weeks that you need for periarticular fibrosis. So let's move on now to the TPLO. I'm sure there are those of you out there that really love doing TPLOs and find it to be a very satisfying procedure. It's unique that it makes no attempt to help out that cranial cruciate ligament. It doesn't attempt to do anything close to what our lateral fibellar tibial suture does. What it does is it allows us to change the slope of the tibia so that we end up with a flat weight-bearing surface so that when this dog steps down, we are stable in a dynamic fashion. So, still have cranial drawer, but when this animal steps down onto the tibia, we've reduced the shear that occurs normally with a caudal slope. By correcting that anatomy, and in this case, going from a point of the cranial cruciate insertion to this caudal point, and then taking a line from this eminence within the tibia and down a point on the hock, and taking a perpendicular line, we can determine that this slope is 28 degrees. Now, that makes for a lot of shear if you're cruciate deficient or if you're cranial cruciate deficient. And so what we would attempt to do is to go ahead and flatten that surface. So it's the whole basis of the repair is by making this biomechanically advantageous in a weight-bearing form. So the instability, again, is important, of course, when the dog is in weight-bearing form. So we've taken care of that by flattening the weight-bearing surface. Again, the tibial compression test allows us to take and decide whether or not this dog has a cruciate ligament injury, because as we take this angle here and place the dog and flex the hock, it's as if the dog is stepping down. And if there's no cranial cruciate ligament, then this portion of the femur is going to slide down this caudal aspect of the tibia. So that's what causes a lot of the pain on these guys too, because during the weight-bearing phase, these forces generate compression on the articular surface of the tibia. And as we well know, the meniscus is sitting there. Shear is created during the weight-bearing phase, and so it drives the femur caudally and then the tibia cranially. It would all be nice if the cranial cruciate ligament was still intact, but that's not always the case. So in the case of the TPLO, what we want to accomplish is to make this cut, this radial cut, off of the slope, and we want to neutralize this to a point where you can see now that it's flat. We don't want to make it to 0 degrees. If we make it to 0 degrees, then we run the risk of harming the caudal cruciate ligament. So ideally, we go from the slope that in this case is probably about 25 degrees to a slope of probably about 4 to 6 degrees. And this shows it again. Slope of about 28 degrees here and here. And what we've done is we've neutralized the slope with the same exact points to about 6 degrees. So you're still left with, well, that's all great. We have an extra capsule repair that we can do pretty readily, and the TPLO can be done, but still, which is the best and for who? And I know we're all sitting on bated breath, so we can decide this easily, but it's not such an easy decision. We need to consider what the possible risks are and complications, you know, because complications with TPLOs probably are a little bit more dramatic. We don't set out to have a complication, but unfortunately, they're going to happen. Expense is greater, too. Because between the TPLO and the extracapsular repairs, you can well imagine, anytime you bring a plate into the picture, TPLO is going to be more expensive. And what's involved in the aftercare? Now, these are all things that I talk to owners about when I'm trying to educate them between the extracapsular repair and the TPLO. The aftercare with the extracapsular repair, both of them need rehabilitation, and it's very important. But with the aftercare and the TPLO, there's cha-ching, more radiographs. You know, there are more examinations, perhaps. And so you've got to tell people this. It does cost more for TPLO at our hospital. But if it's the better procedure, then you certainly can talk to people about that, and it shouldn't be the driving force. And what about that dog that isn't a surgical candidate? Other presence of orthopedic disease, systemic illness, there are so many other things that can go on with these guys that neither one of the procedures might be recommended. You know, you have dogs that have concurrent orthopedic problems such as hip problems, and maybe the owners don't want to pursue this. There are other ways to help these guys. A surgery is probably the best option, but it doesn't happen. You also need to talk to these owners about bilateral consideration. They're so not amused by me when they come to pick up their animal and we're discharging, and I tell them, well, it'd be a good idea to go ahead and put about $20 a week into a bank account, because there is probably greater than about a 50% chance that it's going to happen on the other side. And I talk to them even about that before the surgery, because a lot of times they're like, well, they've got three legs to stand on, and so this should be fine. But you need to talk to them realistically about the fact that it's oftentimes a bilateral disease. An interesting topic, too, and what I hear people talk about is that they're quick to fix cranial cruciate ruptures because they don't want to overload the other side and don't want the other side to go. I don't really know that that's as much of a consideration. Usually within 18 months, regardless if we fix them or not, the other side does become a problem if it's going to become a problem. So it's within a year and a half, or sometimes even two, that we see these guys back for the other side. Sometimes we see them back for the other side after we haven't even gotten a chance to fix the other side. So take this home. This is the take-home message. To date, there is no objective literature to support that one procedure is better than the other. Yes, that includes the TPLO versus the extracapsular repair. The majority of the dogs with the TPLO do return to the normal sit test. That is, they're able to flex their knee and flex their hock underneath their body as they're sitting. And they do. The TPLO, they do tend to walk out of the hospital. I know you probably have some extracapsulars as well that will hold their leg up for 2 to 3 weeks until you can get them to put that leg down and really bear much weight at all. But when you look at them objectively at 6 months or a year down the road, and you look at what's been reported, both of them form osteoarthritis, but both of them have good functional outcome done properly and with proper owner compliance and post-operative management. These guys do well 1 year out. So this is always what you hate to see. The one that comes in that, you know, what do I do, you know? My heart's telling me that I should refer this. And I do. You know, I wait. I'm like, ooh, I'm going off clinics in about a week. Can you come back in next week, please? But, you know, I never would set to pass off. But those big, fat, lazy dogs, what do you recommend? What do you recommend? You know, it's a hard call. You know, I do think that putting some of these dogs, and it depends on the case, through a TPLO, it's a more invasive procedure to me than the extracapsular repair. And you have a dog that moves from this position to on top of the central air and then back and maybe into the TV room and into the food bowl, and that's about it. You know, so does this dog need a TPLO versus an extracapsular repair? When talking about arthrotomy versus arthroscopy, I think this is very important to our decision-making scheme as well. because we don't always have the ability to do arthroscopy, and that's okay. But the more and more, the farther along that we're getting on with our surgical techniques, it is suggesting that these arthroscopically assisted stifles had a shorter or less morbidity associated in the short term. A year down the line, no, you know, they probably both respond as well. But also, what we need to consider is there's more and more literature coming out, or more and more talk, too, about getting a better view with arthroscopy. That is, I was speaking with someone just a little while ago about how hard it is to see that caudal aspect of the meniscus. And with arthroscopy, you really do get a good view, and you're able to manipulate, you know, with practice, of course, that caudal aspect of the tibial plateau to really appreciate what's going on with that meniscus. So arthroscopy probably is good in the short term, and the better and better that we get with the techniques, maybe in the long term too, because we can appreciate meniscal tears that maybe we wouldn't be able to see on arthrotomy. Also, with arthroscopy, it's nice because with the extracapsular repair, when we do arthroscopy with the extracapsular repair, I mean, we really are doing pretty minimal dissection, especially if we're using any kind of suture or bone anchors. We can get this done relatively quickly without a lot of dissection, and that really, I think, lends to a return to function a little bit quicker. Okay, so the tibial tuberosity advancement. Wow, yet another thing that we have to memorize and offer to people. It's been actually pretty exciting to see what they've come up with. And again, it mimics the TPLO in the fact that we're not getting static stabilization. We're not really relying on stabilization when this animal's lying on his side. We're still getting a dynamic stabilization when the dog is in weight-bearing mode. And it eliminates that crane or tibial compression, or that tendency of the tibia to move cranially, by lengthening the lever arm of the quadriceps. So you're bringing that tibial plateau forward, you're lengthening that lever arm of the quadriceps, and you're able to get stability by pulling that straight patellar tendon out to about 90 degrees with the plateau. So it's the same thing. You're essentially flattening your weight-bearing surface. Not exactly the same as a TPLO, but you're altering the mechanics so that you get a dynamic stabilization. It's really nice. We went through a few early on. I'd say it's been about a year and a half ago. The cut is made here on the tibial tuberosity, and what happens is after a measurement where we see where that straight patellar tendon is 90 degrees with the tibial plateau, that tells us how far that we need to get or to advance that tibial plateau or tuberosity. The problem is that, you know, with TPLOs, those of you that do TPLOs, I always feel like, wow, this is so scientific, dot, 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 just, you know, so many degrees. I find there's a lot of variation in kind of measuring with these two. We did about 10 of them at Texas A&M, it's been about a year and a half ago, and half of those dogs didn't do very well, and two ended up with post-op meniscal tears. And I think that it's a little bit fussier with the measurement, although I've heard people say that they aren't as concerned with the measurement, and I think that what happened to us is we weren't putting in large enough baskets to move this tibial tuberosity far enough cranial. The nice part is that I get almost a little still, you know, I get the shivers when we're making that giant cut in the tibia. I hope this is right, you know, because that is a very invasive procedure. The nice part about the tibial tuberosity advancement, the TTA, is this is a little bit more forgiving cut, or it's a little bit easier cut to make. It's a little bit more streamlined plate to hold this in place. And then this basket is placed to keep it expanded. And it's a little bit faster and a little less time consuming. So here's a picture of immediate post-op. I mean, what the heck is that? You know, it just looks like science fiction. So you put the plate on here and you see where our cut is. Our basket is secured by two screws. And then it shows in a period of about 8 weeks, and really if you see them about 12 weeks down the road, you can see that this area has really filled in where we made our cut and advanced the tuberosity forward. Arthroscopy. I get really excited about arthroscopy, but it also still keeps me very grounded because there is a very steep learning curve. But if you're interested in doing arthroscopy, there are tons of places to learn to do it. ACVS generally will offer workshops. I know North American offers workshops. I don't know if Western, I think the Western Veterinary Conference. There are other CE events that you can look up online to learn arthroscopy. Yes, it is a lot of money, but it's interesting and it keeps you motivated, especially if you're interested in doing orthopedics, to continue on. With arthroscopy, it's a diagnostic tool. It helps us grade osteoarthritis. It helps us truly see what's going on with the cranial cruciate ligament and the medial meniscus. And we avoid arthrotomy, which I think helps. And being a person who's gone through the process a few times, I would have a scope done and I'd be back on my bike in 3 days. So I think that we can transfer a little bit of that, not to sound, you know, like I'm trying to make my dog like me, but I really think that it probably makes them more comfortable. Just to go over some of our ports that we like to use with arthroscopy, this is the medial aspect of the limb. We're going to introduce the camera into this area so that we can look across the knee. Most importantly, into the medial meniscus is where we like to use this. We will, though, if we're looking at the lateral aspect, switch the port over and put it on the medial aspect to look across. We can switch that back and forth, but from a standard view, we introduce the camera on the lateral aspect, and then from the medial aspect, we use most of our instruments to try to debride with a shaver any sort of remnants of the cranial cruciate ligament or the meniscus. This is a picture. If you have the... Oh, it works better if I push that. If we have the femur here with the trochlear groove here, and we're looking under. This is the patella here, and these are osteophytes that have formed, but we're able to look. This is looking from distal to proximal up the femur, and this is very indicative of chronic change and osteophyte formation. This is a little blurry, but this shows us what we see when we first put the scope in. This is all my worst nightmare. This is called the fat pad, and this really just hangs out to make my life more miserable. But what we need to do is we'll get a glimmer of where this is obviously lateral and this is medial. We'll get an idea of the torn cranial cruciate ligament coming off the medial aspect of the lateral condyle, and we want to get in here and we want to shave some of this fat pad down. But that's kind of our initial view that we see. We get in here with a moderately aggressive shaver and we start to break down or start to work away at this fat pad. Sometimes it's very vascular, especially in chronic disease, and that can obscure your view a bit. Once we get down and we've taken away all of this fat pad, we can get an idea of taking away. This is the torn cruciate ligament here. The caudal cruciate ligament is back here in the back or in the caudal portion coming from the medial condyle, and it's more straight up and down. The cranial cruciate ligament lies more on its side. And then we go ahead at this point, and we are taking down the fibers of the cranial cruciate ligament, not so much because we need to get them gone and have a supremely clean joint, but what we want to be concerned about is we must visualize the medial and the lateral meniscus. So the meniscus, I really do feel, is the key to success or failure. We can, you know, we always try to do our best job on stabilization of the knee, whether it's extracapsular or TPLOs or TTAs. But if you don't take care of the meniscus, you don't get a good view of the meniscus and deal with it, the dog is more than likely never going to be sound. That's a very important concept. So meniscal tears, that's what's going to cause them to be persistently lame. You must debride that torn portion. There's more and more talk about trying to suture the meniscus back together. But truthfully, I think that just debriding the meniscus, we find these guys do pretty well. And I think if we ever got to the point where we were really trying to take these bucket handles and reattach them, I don't think that our owners would be as happy, and I don't think we'd get as many dogs that are as sound as quickly as if we just go ahead and debride it. Many surgeons do release the meniscus, and we talked a little bit about that. By releasing this meniscus, this is the caudal and medial meniscus, by releasing it, we've gotten it out of the way. So in times of, let's say we decide to do a lateral fibellar tibial suture, we haven't really done anything with that caudal slope. It's in an older dog. We get the knee nice and stable, but maybe we still have about 5 millimeters of cranial drawer. Those are the dogs that I probably, if I didn't release the meniscus, wish I had, because that medial meniscus is very, very well adhered to that tibial plateau. It can't get out of the way. So by taking and releasing this meniscus, either in the position here just behind the collateral ligament, or at a point here at this small ligament that is attached to the tibial plateau, then we've allowed, regardless of the procedure that we've decided to do, to let it move a little bit more. There was also some discussion about whether or not these dogs' knees are still as stable. Because as you can well imagine, especially the lateral meniscus, but the medial meniscus really lends itself to helping the knee be stable and healthy, so why should we go in and muck around with it? But they have found with medial release that these dogs still do very well. But the fact of the matter is that we're talking about post-op meniscal tears after surgical procedures, maybe in the realm of 15 to 20%. And, you know, is that enough for us to go in and say, okay, let's go in and affect this environment and cut this meniscus? You know, is that worth doing that? And that's a good question. But we're getting more and more to the point where it's being advocated to release the meniscus. And I will tell you that in extracapsular repairs, more often than not, I will. If I go in with a TPLO and I see a perfectly pristine, normal meniscus, more often than not, I will leave it alone. Because theoretically, in my mind, we've taken care of that weight-bearing surface. That weight-bearing surface is between 4 and 6 degrees. We shouldn't have that dog's femur creating shear or sliding off of the back of the tibia. So am I worried about there being a latent or a late meniscal tear? That's a very good question. So I think we're still learning, and I think that the ones that come back, I think oftentimes too, we miss them. That we go in with arthroscopy and we don't always appreciate when a meniscal tear is there. And I wonder if that's not the ones that are coming back too. Okay, so this is a arthroscopic picture of us going ahead and debriding a meniscus that has a bucket handle tear, and you can tell it's come forward, and we've probably cut it and then pulled it forward, and we go ahead and we shave that down. It can also be grabbed with graspers, but sometimes it takes a little bit longer. So here's the technique that if we decide to do an arthrotomy that we want to do to see that caudal and medial portion of the meniscus. I use, depending on the size of the dog, a pretty large size Homan. You know, you can use the smaller Homans, obviously, in the smaller dogs, but you need there to be a sizable portion of it distally that you can hook into the back of the tibia, and you put it right in the femoral, the groove, the trochlear groove here, and you lean on it. It pushes, it creates the most extreme cranial thrust you could ever see, but you're able, through externally and internally rotating the hock, and two, I'll take a Sen retractor and pull what's left of the fat pad down, because what I need to see is right back here. And then I'll take one of the little right angle probes and I'll sneak in underneath that meniscus and I'll pull on it to see if anything comes out. If it's nice and secure during the arthrotomy, I have to assume that it's probably okay. But make sure that you're also appreciating the lateral meniscus as well. I think there are enough of those that are hanging out to haunt us that we need to look at the lateral meniscus too. Okay, what do we do with cats? Especially cats that food is love. Overweight cats do present for spontaneous cranial cruciate ligament ruptures. The procedure that is probably recommended, I did read a case report of a very extreme caudal slope in which they did a tibial wedge as well as a TPLO on a cat. But quite frankly, I think they do pretty well with extracapsular repairs. This is the problem. The problem is that, okay, Mrs. Smith, you need to keep your cat in a small carrier for the next 8 to 10 weeks while the periarticular fibrosis forms. That's going to go over like a lead balloon. The cat's going to yowl. The cat's going out of the kennel by about 3 or 4 days. So the cats don't get any rest. And generally, when we have examined these cats down the road, they've not really done that well with the procedure. You know, and so a lot of times in cats, I will take the conservative approach. Cats aren't knuckleheads like dogs, and so I think they do a little bit better job of protecting themselves as far as meniscal tears. I don't see as many meniscal tears in cats that we've left alone. I'm quicker to fix a cat for a patella luxation than I am a cranial cruciate rupture. It's not wrong to do it, and there was an abstract that was published that discussed one year down the line with cats and showed that maybe because they're just very, very, you know, svelte creatures, they don't tend to form the osteoarthritis that dogs do. So it's not wrong to fix a cat. I just don't know that it's necessary. So each case should be taken case by case, and you know, just keep in mind that surgery might not be the silver bullet for them. Maybe weight loss. So again, the risk of conservative therapy, meniscal tear is number one. Also, the progression of osteoarthritis. It's going to come, and it's going to come quickly. So, and again, if they rupture on the other side and they're so far progressed with osteoarthritis on the one side, you know, they're very, it's a very, there's a very good chance that they could become non-ambulatory and just be completely down. And that's a really tricky one to then have to deal with, because it becomes difficult to get these dogs up even if you fix the side that's more chronic, because they're not standing on the acutely ruptured side. If you fix the acutely ruptured side, they haven't been using the chronic side, and you have yourself in a big mess. The complications that we see associated with extracapsular repair really has to do with the material. The material either breaking at the knot, or the material breaking through its fastening device. There is a risk of suture infection. And I just had a dog about 2 weeks ago that still has, even after material removal 3 or 4 months ago, has tracks, dissecting abscesses down the gastroc and cranial tibial muscles, where the it happened in a gravity-dependent way. They can be pretty vicious infections. So it's not without its share of problems. Also, you have problems with pain around the fibula. You know, probably that's the biggest argument for using that femoro-fibellar ligament as a source of anchoring rather than the lateral fibula, is because I have seen dogs that we've pulled pretty tight. I had a little white poodle named Petey that just would never, he screamed and hollered every time you placed any pressure on his fibula. And I think he was having pain associated with his fibula. Also, again, be mindful of the point you're putting it, not too far down the tibia. Keep it as proximal and caudal as possible. And lastly, I got to do my first extracapsular repair with my mentor when I was a fourth-year student. She let me kind of do the surgery, and very patient and very nice, on one of my classmates' dogs. And somehow I managed to entrap the peroneal nerve. It does happen. And what ends up happening is these dogs are excruciatingly painful, and they won't extend their leg and place it on the ground. If you have that situation, hospitalize the animal, give it a few days, see if you can't get the dog through the perioperative period. But if you're getting on a week or two with this dog losing muscle mass, especially in the cranial tibial and along the thigh musculature, there's a possibility that you've entrapped the peroneal nerve. You really have to, you have to get pretty aggressive to get it, but I managed. And if you are, if you're ever wondering where it is, as you pull the fascia back from the biceps, look down that lateral aspect, and sometimes you can see that peroneal nerve. If you're staying up against your fibula, if you're using your femoral fibellar ligament, you're not going to run into this problem. But just be mindful that if you ever see this sort of situation come into your hospital, whether you've done the surgery or not, hospitalize the dog, treat for pain, and make sure that that's not the case. You can always place another suture. If you leave that on there and you get a certain degree of muscle atrophy, that's a hard thing to come back from. Yes? What causes the late meniscal tear? You know, if you've got it repaired properly, I mean, you can still have some degree of cranial translation of the knee. You can have inward rotation, just like any other meniscus. It would be breakdown of the material a little bit, allowing more cranial drawer, would be eventually what I think would lead to late meniscal tears. If you had less than 3 millimeters of cranial translation, I don't think you'd be as liable. But over time, you're going to get loosening of that material. Autogenous tissue loosens with time, you know, years and years and years. So that's when you see it. You don't see it 3 weeks down the line usually. You see it months to years down the line. Complications associated with TPLOs. That's my deal. I'll have people call and say, gosh, I really want to do TPLOs. And I'm like, that's great, you know. If you have a chance to take the course or get somebody to teach you to do them, that's fantastic. I think it's not doing the TPLOs. I think it's dealing with the complications. The complications will come at you and you'll just be like, oh my God, I'm never going to do another one of these. But you can deal with these complications. Avulsion of the tibial crest was a common complication that we saw early on, but we're really doing our best to move our cuts more proximal, making smaller cuts and leaving more substantial portions of the tibial crest. So that was one when we were making our cuts lower, when they were taking a greater piece of the tibia and rotating it. It's something we don't see as often. Most of the times, those can be conservatively managed. Rest the dog. There's oftentimes a bit of callus formation there quickly, and these dogs will do okay. But generally, there are two things that cause that to happen. Either you've not left enough tibial crest, which hopefully that's not the case, or you have an owner that doesn't understand rest, and that will happen. Another thing is plate loosening or failure. It happens, you know, especially with dogs that are a little bit too active. Tibial fracture has happened. I've not seen that happen, but I've heard people talk about it. Patellar tendonitis is probably the thing that we can't really quantify, but we like to blame it on that, on the dogs that don't do so well in the short term. Because think about it. We're in there, we're making a cut, we're yanking that patellar tendon back, we're shifting that piece. There's a lot of manipulation. And the weight-bearing forces have changed. So if you're not giving enough time for accommodation of the body, strengthening of the quadriceps, you may get some patellar tendonitis. And it's something that if we can't come up with anything else, we kind of throw our hands up. But you will see thickening of the tendon across the patella, and sometimes arguably you can say that could be a source of lameness or persistent problems after surgery. The patellar luxation is also a favorite of mine. I'm really good at creating lateral luxations, and it happened to me once, and it's, you just need to be very conscientious about the way that your cuts are being made, but it is a real thing, and I warn owners about that. We don't seem to see them very often, but it can happen. You can also fail to rotate enough. That is, the dog still has tibial compression. When you place it in weight bearing, there's still a certain amount of caudal slope. 8 to 10 degrees can really affect how the repair turns out. You can also over rotate. That is, put it at 0 degrees, cause a problem with the caudal cruciate ligament. There have been study after study after study saying that, you know, we really need to stop at 4 degrees, folks, because we're causing pathology in the caudal cruciate ligament. The screws in the joint are also ones that are usually happen at 6 o'clock at night when you think you're finished with surgery and you go in and you see that there's a screw in the joint. That doesn't generally tend to cause a long-term problem, but there has been talk, and we have seen, if we get a second look with arthroscopy, sometimes you will see indentations in that area, and that really could probably lend itself, since it's articular, to be a problem long-term if these dogs, or an explanation if these dogs aren't doing well. Wound complications, it's just one of those things you don't like to see. Dogs either having, with the TPLO, because there is quite a bit of dissection, these dogs get very edematous sometimes, and the edges of the wounds will be quite moist, and there's a lot of fluid associated with it, so they'll be slow to heal sometimes. Probably more often than not, though, the wound complications that we see associated with TPLOs are self-inflicted. So again, the TPLO is more expensive. It gets upwards of about $600 to $700 more in our practice, and that's with the repeat radiographs. Generally, they come back at 8 and sometimes 16 weeks. If they come in at anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks and they're making good progress, sometimes we don't have them come back in, but I'd almost rather see them at 10 to 12 weeks. It's just, I think the owners get a little impatient. But they need sometimes one or two sets of radiographs postoperatively. Also, we have a saw that we need that's special. The instrumentation is also very expensive. And two, it is a little bit longer procedure, again, than the extracapsular repair. We have to know that aftercare is very important. The rehabilitation on both patients, I tell owners, is a period of about 12 weeks. We have them get very active with the patients regardless of which procedure we use, by icing and doing passive range of motion. Bandages are usually only kept on for a period of 24 hours unless there's a problem with a lot of fluid accumulation, especially at the distal aspect of the TPLO incisions. Short, slow leash walks with a short leash are implemented immediately and generally are the norm with both procedures. I will let them get a little bit more step aggressive with TPLOs, but seriously, with the extracapsular repairs, we're waiting for scar tissue to form. So jogs around the block are not good. We need them to be quiet. Even wandering around in the house is a lot of exercise for either one of these procedures. We don't have TPLO patients swim early, but sometimes we will have the extracapsular patients after a period of about, I'd say anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, start getting in the pool, especially dogs who have weight issues. Recheck 6 to 8 weeks. Sometimes we'll go 8 to 10 weeks. So with extracapsular repair, most surgeons will fix the acute side first and then reoperate or operate the other side at 8 to 12 weeks when we have bilateral procedures. Some people will do TPLOs bilaterally. I don't usually choose to do that because especially the fact that they're oftentimes very large dogs and they're difficult with nursing care. It's not really so much a convenience for us. I just really think it knocks them back. But I have seen surgeons do bilateral procedures and the dogs have done very well, especially if the owners just want to get done with it once and for all. Okay, so we have the large dog that is not a surgical candidate. Rehab, rehab, rehab. Associate yourself with someone who really digs rehab if you don't do that yourself. Swimming, underwater treadmill, e-stem, all sorts of ultrasound. There are tons of different things we can do to help these guys. And seriously, if we have taken care of the meniscus, and in this case, this guy's name is Winston, and he was a happy guy. He was able to go to surgery on one leg, but on the other side, the owners didn't have the money. We kept him. He lost 25 pounds. And actually, we injected the other knee with a combination of steroid and hyaluronic acid, and he did very well long term. So, again, I said this before, when we're trying to decide if the acute lameness is from canine hip dysplasia or craniocruciate ligament disease, really, again, it's the knee until proven otherwise. Dogs don't walk on their radiographs. I've seen dogs be perfectly happy with hideous hips like this until they blow their cruciate. So be absolutely, you know, thorough with your examination and see. If the dog has a medial buttress and canine hip dysplasia, the cruciate ligament is probably the problem. But I also tell people, dogs very rarely return to 100%, you know, with canine hip dysplasia and concurrent cranial cruciate ligament rupture, because I think they still do have issues with their hips. So rather than sell the people the line, well, we'll fix the knee, everything will be fine, I think we have to be reasonable in the assessment. The partial cranial cruciate rupture, how do we get around that? It's very difficult to detect. We need to make sure that we're checking for laxity and flexion and extension. And the sit test is often the most important thing. These dogs will fail their sit test. They won't flex their stifle as readily in the early stages of partial rupture. So just keep that in mind. Critically review your radiographs if you take them. So which one is the one that's affected? Well, that's a really good question. But you have to wonder about the amount of effusion that's beginning to form here and on the caudal aspect of the knee and the amount of DJD. Unstable knees form DJD. So look for that increased opacity to each side where a normal amount of effusion should be in this caudal pocket as well. And that helps you know that maybe though you can't palpate effusion, the early effusion that is forming that you can see radiographically might be telling you that you've got a brewing cruciate ligament rupture. So have a good working knowledge of the surgeries. Even if you choose not to do TPLOs, doesn't mean that you can't talk to an owner about it. It's very much a very sensible or, you know, a very easy procedure to, especially with a series of diagrams, explain. Be able to talk to the owners about risk and expense. Very much a factor with the two procedures that are usually recommended. And keep in mind that surgeon's preference and experience does play a giant role. if you're not comfortable with the procedure, I mean, it's not that anybody's being ever critical of you, and don't get pressed into doing something that you're not comfortable with. You know, don't try your first intracapsular repair on 110-pound Pyrenees. Regardless of the size of the dog, surgery is recommended. There is a poor prognosis that's associated once their meniscus is ruptured and once, you know, significant osteoarthritis has begun to form. So if anything you take away from this talk today, please remember that. And at this point, none of these dogs have cranial cruciate ruptures or elbow disease. These are the fabulous dogs of Copper Mountain. If y'all get a chance to get up there and see them, they are great dogs, and they're great to watch work. Thank you so much for your attention. Y'all have been super. I appreciate it. And I'll answer any questions you have.